Okay, we're on the record here. Welcome to the House Resources Committee. We're called to order at 1:24 p.m. on Wednesday, February 15, 2023. We are meeting in Capitol Room 124. Present with us today is Representative Sadler, Representative Wright, Representative Rauscher, Representative Armstrong, Representative Dibert, and Representative McCabe, and myself, Representative Chairman McKay. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to do business, and we're just being joined by Representative Mears. I'd like to thank our recorder, Justin, and our moderator, Jake, for helping keep everything in order today, and also my committee aide, Ed King. As a reminder, please silence your cell phones. Please note that today's agenda has changed. We will postpone and hear about statehood defense at a later date. Today, we're going to have our second hearing on HB 50, the carbon storage bill. And I was going to ask, I guess the presenters will tell us which tab we're going to go to here in our book so that we know where, get everybody on the same page before we begin. We will bring HB 50 back before the committee under bills previously heard. This is the second hearing on HB 50. The plan today is to gain a better understanding of the mechanics of the bill. Director Aaron O'Quinn and Deputy Commissioner John Crowther are here with us today to walk through the bill analysis. Welcome back, gentlemen. Please put yourselves on the record and begin your testimony. And please advise us where to go in our books. Thank you.
Good afternoon, House Resources. My name is Aaron O'Quinn. I'm the leasing section manager for the Division of Oil and Gas. The presentation that we're going to give today was passed out today. The front page of it looks like the title screen that you see before you. Apologize that I don't know the tab number.
That's okay. Everybody find it all right? Okay, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Chair McKay. For the record, this is John Crowther. What we're going to do today, this will be primarily led by Aaron O'Quinn here, is just go through this PowerPoint, which goes through the sectional analysis of the bill, summarizing at a high level the different concepts captured in the bill in the kind of group sections. There's a few slides up front that do that, just to provide context and a frame of reference for the committee. And then we'll literally go section by section. Obviously, some of the sections are related. Some of them are quite significant. Some of them are conforming. So we'll just indicate that throughout the course of our presentation. But unless there's any other questions or frame-up comments from the committee, I'll turn it over to Aaron and let him begin.
Okay, please continue. Thank you.
Thanks, John. So just to get you guys started here, we're going to start with a summary of the project process. We're going to show two slides on that, kind of walk through different stages of a project and kind of certain aspects of the proposed bill that concern each component of the project process. We're going to talk about some of the funding mechanisms for both the regulatory component, the state's kind of revenue component, meaning the money that the state is going to be, you know, earning to be used in the general fund or transferred to the permanent fund. And then we're going to talk about some of the other regulatory fees that are charged for the administration of the permits and post-closure liability. We'll then go through the sectional analysis with specific attention paid to sections 14 and sections 31. So those deal with the Department of Natural Resources property rights oversight section, and then the AOGCC's regulatory / permitting section. And then we'll talk through some other provisions of the bill that touch on other conforming amendments, as Deputy Commissioner Crowther said. So we'll just start with this. We've kind of talked about this in our previous presentation to the committee, But basically, this shows kind of how a carbon capture project flows. You start with exploration and delineation. We have the code sections that are relevant to those components of the project. And then you move into your permitting process and your investment decision process. And then once you've kind of delineated your acreage and you've figured out exactly which acreage you want to use from the larger acreage that you might have been entitled to explore, then you go into a leasing process. You start your storage operations. Once your storage operations have concluded, there's a post-closure period, and then you go into this facility closure period. And then after that post-closure period, the state of Alaska assumes the title to that carbon dioxide and also the liability. So again, a similar slide, but here we're showing some timeline aspects to it. So I'm not going to dwell on those, but just to kind of revisit some of the concepts from our last presentation, from project conception to construction and injection, you're looking at a period that could be from 5 to 10 years. So this slide really brings that home.
Okay, any questions so far? Okay, please proceed.
Okay, so we'll first start with some of our funding mechanisms for this project. The idea behind the bill is that the regulatory program that oversees carbon capture will be self-funded through a regulatory cost charge. And so what we do have in the bill are the receiving of different fees that are paid by the regulated entities. There's permit fees. There's fees, a per ton injection fee that goes directly into the administrative fund. The intent is that the regulatory agency, in this case the AOGCC, has those funds and expends them as they collect them. So they're designed to really cover their costs.
Well, okay, Rep. Sadler has a question.
Thank you, through the chair, Mr. O'Quinn. This is kind of related to the previous slide a bit, but AOGCC, the previous slide says that they're going to seek primacy for Class 6 wells. Don't know how long that's going to take. The timeline on slide 4 indicates there might be as many as 3 years before AOGCC would need to weigh in. Does AOGCC's primacy request or effort represent a potential bottleneck or a roadblock to progress on carbon capture projects?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, this is John Crowther for the record. So the primacy pursuit is when we have members of the AOGCC, some of the commissioners online, if you have specific questions about their view of the cost or process. But the pursuit of that primacy does have to be reviewed and authorized by the EPA, the U.S. federal EPA. And so we do view that as a potential bottleneck. It's expected to take some time in any event. The positive things we've seen are that other states are currently in that process. So the EPA is expecting those kinds of authorizations. They've issued some memo guidances that indicate a favorability for states seeking that primacy and some funding opportunities, as we discussed with the committee last hearing. And so the indications are that there's support and prioritization to move through that quickly, but it certainly could be a bottleneck. And I would just note in the context of the material presented on slide 5, that is about the operations fees associated with the ongoing project. The fiscal note prepared by AOGCC, I believe, speaks to the kind of startup in part associated with seeking primacy. And I definitely don't want to preempt the commissioners from speaking to the details there. But
follow up.
Thank you, through the chair, Mr. Crowther. So the point I'm trying to make is that if the legislature were to pass this bill this session and set this in motion, can we have confidence that the AOGCC Class 6 primacy would be available, reviewed, approved, stamped, and delivered in time for it to approve any project that might come up in the next 3-4 years?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, and I would defer to the commissioners, that the legislation authorizes them to seek primacy. It doesn't mandate it as drafted. We have a belief that if the commission assessed and did pursue it, that we would likely receive it within a 2-3 year time frame at the latest. and that that's consistent with what operators are seeing across the country, and so it would be appropriate for moving forward with projects, if that answers your question.
Thank you.
If the AOGCC does not have that primacy, we would presumably you would just get the Class 6 well permit through the EPA. It's not necessarily a bottleneck. Representative McCabe has a question.
Thank you. Through the chair, so and this is on this timeline, the previous slide or maybe the previous two slides. Interested where somewhere in here there should be consulting firms where you've actually gone outside of the DNR and looked at consultants like Stantec. I'm wondering if there's any reports that we can read, Stantec reports or somebody else that's actually done some consulting on the efficacy of this project, if you will, and maybe even pro and con, just so that we can do our due diligence.
So can I just mention that Representative Pukatuk has joined us?
So through the chair, Representative McCabe, so we do have a Stantec report that did survey other jurisdictions to kind of compare how they're overseeing their programs. I'm not sure if that gets to the exactly to the meat of your question. Going back to the Class 6, just to give a real-world example, Louisiana has an application for Class 6 primacy pending before the EPA currently. And what we're seeing is the industry that is pursuing injection facilities in that state has applied to the EPA for those permits. There is some commonality in the way the EPA evaluates those and the way the state of Louisiana is going to evaluate those. And so the idea is that once primacy is achieved by the state, there can be a pretty quick handoff of those permit applications and reviews from the EPA back down to the state. But I would just echo all of the comments made by Deputy Commissioner Crowther here. We have some additional products that will be coming online from our consultant. One of those is a review of commercial terms among different jurisdictions so that you all will be able to see how the minimum values that we've proposed in the bill compare to other jurisdictions. And, you know, you can compare that with the maturity of our market and that sort of thing. And then, of course, when the AOGCC goes to seek primacy, there's a number of technical requirements and regulatory requirements, crosswalks between the state regulations and the federal regulations that will have to be achieved. And I'm sure that they will have to engage with some outside consultants. I don't want to speak to them, and I shouldn't have said sure, but they are on the line if you would like to direct any questions directly to the AOGC, the commissioners from the AOGCC.
Follow up, Kevin?
That'd be great. Don't really have a question for them. I'm hoping that, provided it's not 6,000 pages, if you could provide the Stantec report and also anything from Gaffney Klein that discusses this project that you think some of us on down here that's not an engineer level could understand. That would be great. It's been suggested to me that there's some material out there that I should read. And so I'd be interested.
Representative McCabe, through the chair, we will certainly circulate both the Stantec report and then broader materials for the committee there.
Representative Rauscher.
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. I just want to make sure I understood what I just heard a little bit ago, that applications, once we receive primacy, will be able to just be handed over to the state, and they won't have to reapply. Is that what you're saying?
I believe that's correct, and I really want to confirm the process with the EPA or with the state of Louisiana before I commit to that, and we will return to the committee with the answer to that question.
I appreciate it for some sort of a, you know, on what that exactly is. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. O'Quinn, looking at slide 4 in the green box in the middle of my project design and permit application, I see a reference to unitization and project exhibits, which raises a question I hadn't even considered before. Would the same surface units and the same unitization that exists now hold over into injection processes, or would there have to be new units created to facilitate this process?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, these would be new units. Our current units are for oil and gas production. These would be for injection. They may be into depleted oil and gas reservoirs, which necessarily a lot of the literature that defines those horizons would be found in those oil and gas units, but it would be a completely new a new property right and amalgamation of that property right through a unit.
And so
follow up
to the chair. And would the existing units remain in effect? I mean, we have a dual parallel stage.
Yeah, Representative Sadler through the chair, John Crowther here. So absolutely, this point of the bill is to contemplate the potential coexistence. That's a core tenet of the bill. All of the oil and gas units continue to be available for development production consistent with their existing terms, with obligations in the bill for no interference if there is activities that seek carbon sequestration in those same areas.
Thank you.
But as Aaron was mentioning, it's possible for a carbon project to form additional new units focused on carbon sequestration that could in theory overlap, but there's also a process in the bill contemplated to avoid interference in those cases.
Commissioner Crowther, I'd like to just clarify one thing for the benefit of the public and all our members here. The AOGCC, to my understanding, is completely funded by the oil and gas industry. It's kind of different than a lot of our agencies. And the agency that would manage carbon storage work would fall under the AOGCC. So they would be funded in the same fashion. It's not really a line item in the state budget. It's sort of like off budget. Can you explain just briefly how that works?
Chair McKay, happy to. It is our understanding that the regulatory cost charge, which funds the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission's current operations assessed against oil and gas operations, would be a very similar mechanism in the carbon sense. I think if appropriate, I might let the commissioners who are online speak to their understanding of how it would work going forward, but from a budgetary sense for their agency. Both Commissioner Wilson and the chair, Commissioner Huber, I believe, are online.
Okay. Mr. Huber or Mr. Wilson, can you clarify just briefly how the AOGC is funded and most importantly they basically pay for themselves by being funded by the oil and gas and the carbon storage industry if it was to come to pass, or both would be funded basically by themselves and doesn't exactly show up on the state budget?
Chairman McKay, thank you for the opportunity. For the record, this is Bryce Huber, AOGCC Chair. I'm joined by Commissioner Wilson and also a couple of our senior staff members. So you are correct that the regulatory cost charge is assessed volumetrically for materials going up or down the well hole, right? So any oil or gas that's produced, any oil that's injected, any water that comes back out of the hole. So it's volumetric, which is spread across the industry. We envision that this new program would not come from that piece, but we envision a similar set of circumstances when we have a regulatory cost charge for the CCUS. And then we would set up a regulatory structure that would assess the amount of money that we need to run the program and use that to base our fees to the CCUS participant. So again, it's supposed to be industry funded and keeps our budget at a non-general fund add. I should note that you've mentioned the fiscal note briefly, and we do have a couple positions listed in our fiscal note, so there might be some startup costs that would need to be general fund as we're trying to spool up and begin this process, whether it be in search of primacy or the parallel process with the federal permitters. But that's down the line. So basically the same way that the regulatory cost charge is now.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much, Commissioner. Okay, we can continue on slide 5.
I believe I'm on slide 5.
Did you finish 5? Okay.
Yes, sir. any additional questions on slide 5 or how the AOGCC would be funded?
Okay, thank you.
Okay, moving on to slide six. So the second revenue source or funding source would be the Closure Trust Fund. This would be a fund that's separate from the general fund that is established in order to earmark funds for post-closure activities. So these would be funds that the state can use, either the DNR, the AOGCC, other agencies that can use to monitor a closed facility, to remediate any issues that may come up. And so the fee would be established in the permitting and regulatory process of the AOGCC, and it would be designed to handle foreseeable impacts that the state could assume from the post-closure perspective.
I think it's important to note, if I may, that CO2 is basically inert. It's not toxic. This isn't like hazardous materials that are buried in landfills or otherwise disposed of, where there's this cradle to grave liability that's pretty serious. I don't see CO2 as being any kind of environmental threat. Is that a true statement, gentlemen?
Yeah, Chair McKay, John Crowther here. So, as a general practical matter, CO2 is in the atmosphere around us. It's non-toxic at a general atmospheric sense. There are, like any industrial operations, required that it be done safely. You know, just industrial accidents, workplace safety is very important, that those things be protected and avoided. But as a general matter, and not speaking as a hazardous chemicals engineer or as a safety regulator, but as a general matter, CO2 has a very different profile than some of the other materials managed by industrial operations or DNR in some areas.
Okay, thank you. Rep. Sadler?
Thank you, through the chair. Again, slide six, creating two accounts, income account and operating account. What is the different function of those two accounts, and are they each equally unsusceptible to the fiscal sweep, et cetera?
Yeah, Representative Sadler, through the chair, if it's all right, we'll get back to the committee with exactly how those accounts are structured, why the bifurcation there. The intent is to enable funds to be available consistent with the budgetary mechanisms of the legislature on both an annual and ongoing long-term basis. And so I suspect that may be why there's both an income account for the funds that are sitting there and an operating account for any current year expectations. But let's just get back to the committee, if that's all right, to confirm that information.
Okay, thank you. Please proceed.
And I would just point out that this fund, specifically the Closure Trust Fund, was designed to be non-sweepable because it is for a long-term purpose.
Fund two accounts.
Mm-hmm. Moving on to slide seven, we'll just talk here briefly about some of the other revenues that we can expect from CCUS licensees. We have revenue provisions to collect rent, royalties and charges, specifically a per acre charge for the acreage that an entity believes that they'll be using, and then there'll be a per ton injection charge. We have provisions to kind of treat all of these revenues the same way we treat various receipts in the oil and gas context. And then specifically, we have a provision that just recognizes that Article 9, Section 15, that some of these revenues may be subject to the 25% allocation to the permanent fund as mineral revenue.
Okay. Rep. Armstrong.
Thank you, through the chair. Mr. O'Quinn, can you help me understand how y'all came up with the minimum rental rate and injection charge? It seems quite low.
Sure. Representative Armstrong, through the chair. Essentially, we surveyed a number of sovereign jurisdictions that licensed their pore space, and we saw private agreements that were higher than this, certainly. Those were in markets that were much more mature and further along, where you were having a lot of competition for acreage among storage operators. Alaska having a relatively young storage market, one that doesn't exist just yet, we wanted to establish minimums to ensure that there was a floor for those revenues somewhere in the statutory context. But we also wanted to allow the market to develop, and we would anticipate that we would receive rents and injection fees higher than that amount. It's just a floor, and it was based on surveying other jurisdictions and kind of reducing that for the maturity of Alaska's market.
Follow-up. Okay, follow-up.
Thank you, through the chair. And if I'm getting a little ahead, let me know. I'm curious why we didn't include a 45Q exemption.
Representative Armstrong, through the chair, when you say 45Q exemption, do you mean a exemption vis-a-vis?
We have the federal. We don't exempt the federal tax credits, and my concern is that with the tax credits, which far exceed this, it just becomes a negative revenue situation for the state. Mm-hmm. I'm happy to walk through some back of the envelope math I did. But as of this point, I can't figure out, based on the minimums and having 45Q not being exempted and paying out those tax credits, we're going to take a huge hit on corporate income tax. And so just want to understand if there was conversation or thinking about why we didn't exempt and we kept the tax credits in.
Yeah, so Representative Armstrong, through the chair, I think it's fair to say the bill as introduced and is brought forward, we didn't address that issue in the text of the bill. That's not to say it's not a very relevant issue, as you said, both from kind of a corporate development of the market perspective, but also from particularly the revenue consequence of the bill. And so I think the lack of addressing it in the current text is not a deliberate choice. It's we wanted to focus on the framework mechanisms, both for the land management in DNR, the regulatory management in AOGCC. But very naturally, those kind of provisions affecting the state revenue code as it incorporates the federal revenue code could be a very relevant topic for addressing in the legislation as well.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Rep. Sadler, did you have a question?
Yes, sir. Through the chair, Mr. O'Quinn, I guess, on this slide again. So these are not new fees, new rental rates. This kind of duplicates what happens with existing subsurface space. This is just delineating specifically these fees can be collected for this purpose.
Rep. Sadler, through the chair, that's correct. In the oil and gas context, we have minimums based on the basin or other requirements. There's royalties based on geography that are established. And so this is a very analogous provision. And again, this bill doesn't necessarily expand the authorities of the DNR or the AOGCC. It just kind of brings this new property rights kind of regime into the statutory context. And so we're handling this in pretty much the exact same way we handled it in the oil and gas context.
Okay. Hey, Representative Wright.
Thank you, Chair. Through the chair, just to follow up Representative Armstrong's question, what is the high end? We're pretty low here when we're charging for the rental space, but what's the high end that you've seen around the country? And also, what does the environment look like for us to get there, and how long will it take?
Representative Wright, through the chair, those are some big questions. And so what I can say is we have seen minimum rental amounts are in the $50 an acre. We've seen even higher than that in areas of direct head-to-head competition between operators, which we could see here. We would typically offer this in a competitive process. And indeed, we'll get into that in the sectional analysis, but it does provide for that. So we would see, bidding on the acreage with a minimum of $20. On the injection fee side, we've seen it higher. We've seen it related to the 45Q. We've seen different things, and different drivers are setting that pricing structure from in other parts of the world, not in the United States typically, but we're seeing carbon taxes driving some of those numbers. But really, it's competition for the acreage that is driving those numbers in the United States. And how we get there is, you know, we set up this framework and we allow the industry to come to us with their carbon for sequestration. And as the industry matures, much like the oil and gas industry has since the 1950s in Alaska, we've seen our, you know, competition for our acreage wax and wane as the market dictates.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Sadler, another shot at it.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the chance to vet this bill thoroughly. I guess I kind of nodded my head, like I understood what Representative Armstrong's question was about the application or not, or the exemption of 45Q and not being a finance guy necessarily. Could you kind of walk me through the revenue stream and what it means to exempt or not exempt the 45Q credits? A credit being a relief of a tax, kind of the plus and minus push-pull, is a little confusing.
Sure. So an operator is assessed if they are a corporation anyway. In Alaska, they're assessed the corporate income tax, but they're also subject to IRS taxation. And so in the Internal Revenue Code, we have Section 45Q, which puts out which defines these tax credits. I believe the state of Alaska has incorporated the Internal Revenue Code, so those tax credits by incorporation also appear in the Alaska Revenue Code. And that's not something that we considered when we were putting together the proprietary, leasing and that sort of thing, that the leasing and permitting components of this bill. But basically, an injector injects their carbon dioxide, and depending on the source of that carbon dioxide, the size of the facility, there's a couple of other factors that go into it. But they're owed a tax credit by the federal government because of the reference, the incorporation by reference of the Internal Revenue Code by the state of Alaska. It's possible that tax credit could be also incorporated into the state revenue code. I'm a land management guy. I'm not a tax guy, so I don't want to step into it.
I don't understand the connection. I would think they're completely separate transactions. The company would pay the state a per acre fee. Let's just say this $20 an acre. And then they would pay the state $2.50 per ton of CO2 that they inject. What they write off on their federal taxes is of no consequence to the state, unless I completely don't understand.
Chair.
Are you done?
I'm done.
Okay, Representative Armstrong.
Just for the benefit of everyone, this was some back-of-the-envelope math we did. Slide 19 from the February 10th presentation has the North Dakota example, and Slide 15 is where you can find the 45Q numbers. The $3.83 million in minimum rents and injection fees would result in a net revenue loss of $17.59 million in corporate income tax to the state because of the way that the tax credits work. So with 45Q right now, we'll be taking, and if you also look at, the fiscal note from the Department of Revenue, they bring this up as well.
So are we talking apples and apples? North Dakota's private property or government?
They put, and correct me if I'm wrong, but this example from North Dakota, they put our numbers to show, if this example were in Alaska. So, with the rent and injection fees, that 3.83 is what we would get for a similar project. That's not the North Dakota number.
And through the chair, the reason for the kind of numbers that Representative Armstrong is talking about is because the Internal Revenue Code is adopted by reference into the Alaska Revenue Code. And so because there's this provision in the IRS code, it also appears in the Alaska statutes by reference. So Alaska essentially has its own 45Q tax credit regime because of that. That's something that can be fixed through an amendment to eliminate that portion of the incorporation. I can't really speak to the exact mechanics of how that's best done, but essentially by adopting the Internal Revenue Code on a pro rata basis, we are we have adopted this tax credit program on the state income tax side. That being said, that's not the intention of this bill. And the intention of this bill, as we've mentioned, is to establish the property rights perspective and to establish the permitting perspective. And there may be additional revisions that need to be made to our revenue statutes or our tax code in order to account for this incorporation of the 45Q.
Okay, well, I think Rep. Armstrong has an excellent question that needs to be answered very clearly for the benefit of everyone. I would just like to point out and have you, for the record, for the public, that this program would work exactly like the permanent fund, where 25% of the revenue goes into the permanent fund, and obviously dividends are paid just like they would be for any other deposit in the permanent fund. Is that correct statement?
So, Chair McKay, John Crowther here for the record, that is correct. The mineral revenues associated with the development would go into the permanent fund. Just to expound a little bit on the discussion we've been having, is as you just highlighted, the per ton injection rate, the rental rates would be revenue to the state. What Representative Armstrong has been highlighting, I believe, is that there's also under current law, which has not been addressed in the bill currently, under current law, there's a state tax credit that accrues to injection because there's currently a federal tax credit and the state tax code incorporates all the federal tax provisions. That's the default for all corporate income tax provisions in the federal code. There's a few existing exemptions into the state tax code that say that those federal provisions aren't incorporated. So it's certainly possible that the legislature, through an amendment to the bill, could similarly exempt the 45Q incorporation on the state level. And that would, the revenues would continue to accrue under the bill at least these minimum levels, potentially higher, driven by competition. The federal tax credit would continue to be in place from the 45Q perspective, but were, say, the committee to adopt an amendment affecting that incorporation in the state code, that state corporate income tax liability would no longer, that state corporate income tax credit would no longer be could be adjusted up or down. And so
I think the point is that we don't want to enter into something where the state would go negative and actually have to pay money to administer our own program. That would seem to be very illogical.
Yeah, Chair McKay.
I'm sorry. Okay. Rep. Armstrong?
Because I love to be an overachiever, I've already started work on an amendment that exempts 45Q, so we can hopefully discuss that at a future meeting.
Okay. Rep. McCabe.
Thank you, Chair McKay. So as I understand it, this is a sort of a framework to allow you to go ahead. Some of the numbers might not be exactly right. We're going to have to put the numbers in after you sort of started and put the numbers in to make it right. I mean, I think that's what I've always understood from the presentation. So I don't know. Maybe we can flesh out the numbers a little bit so that they make this make a little bit more sense to us. But as far as it being a framework, that's kind of what I always figured. So.
Representative McCabe, through the chair, that's exactly correct. We view this as critical to establish the framework from the land management and regulatory side. It's very natural that the legislature and the legislation addresses the revenue side in an appropriate way as well, so that we're generating the state revenue. The intent of the bill is to generate state revenue in addition to enable the industry.
Follow up, Kim. This is sort of historical, or it's history repeating itself. We did the same thing with oil exploration, essentially. We established a framework. We didn't know what the price of a barrel of oil was going to be. We needed the framework to get the land and the leases and everything else. And then as things progressed, we made $900 million and spent it immediately. So then we changed things a little bit and did some different things. So, am I wrong on that?
No, Representative McCabe, through the chair, I think you're right that you know, we have a lot more experience from the history we've had with oil and gas that we can use to inform our history of CCUS, but it's certainly, as the industry expands, evolves, we expect commercial terms, revenues, management styles to evolve as well.
Thank you.
Okay, staff advises me that we can always have the Department of Revenue present at the next meeting to maybe go into this in a little more detail so that we flush it out. Okay, Rep. Puckett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Switching gears a little bit from the to the aspect of real property tax, I'm just not looking for answers to any questions, but I'm curious as to how it applies when we get to the injection equipment. If it's not state-owned, then it's not subject to the 2015 was SB. I forget the SB that exempted state property from being able to be rolled into a state assessment tax that, you know, is utilized by the municipality. And then similarly, where we've got the example with Point Thompson, where they've got real assets, but they utilize some market value as to the stranded gas that goes into their assessed value. As we pursue catching the fart in the wind and getting a value on it, once it gets put into the ground, what role does that play in, I guess, the assessed property value, whether it's surface or subsurface? So I'd like to pursue that at some point, and understanding where Kevin, Representative McCabe's coming from, that this is an idea, but I'm curious as to that. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, seeing no other questions on this slide, we're due to finish at 3 o'clock. We have nine more slides, so please continue, gentlemen.
All right, without further ado, we'll get into the sectional analysis. As I said, sections 14 and sections 31 are the big sections. So I'll try to kind of move through the other sections somewhat quickly, but of course, please, questions are, I like talking about this stuff. So section one, short title of the bill, it's pretty self-explanatory. We're calling it Carbon Capture Utilization and Storage Act. Section two grants the AOGCC to regulate carbon storage unit operations the same way they regulate oil and gas operations. We just made that conform to the oil and gas context. Section 3 authorizes the AOGCC to seek primacy for Class 6 injection wells. Again, that's a that's not a mandate. That is a may seek primacy. Section 4 creates that carbon storage closure fund in the manner that was provided on the earlier slide, and that's, you know, designed to be non-sweepable again, to fund post-closure operations once the state takes title of that carbon dioxide. Section 5, there's a mineral estate disposal exemption in the ag lands disposal for oil and gas. This basically would still permit carbon storage on lands slated for agricultural disposal. The idea being with oil and gas, similarly to oil and gas, you know, we have a small footprint, so it's unlikely that the surface area would be significantly impacted by these operations to interfere with that agricultural lands disposal. Section 6 deals with our kind of general leasing provisions in the Alaska Land Act, and it basically says that carbon storage is exempted from those provisions. So, you know, we can't authorize carbon storage under the general land leasing provisions. Section 7 deals with the split estate. So when the state disposes of surface land to, say, somebody purchasing land in a land sale or something like that, the state reserves its minerals as required under the Statehood Act. And basically, if the state is exploiting its mineral resources, its subsurface resources, there's a requirement that the lessee reach an agreement with the surface owner. And then there's the ability for the Department of Natural Resources to step in and police that process through requiring bonding or that sort of thing if they can't reach an agreement. We've never had to do that. Section...
Okay, excuse me, Rep. McCabe has a question on number 7.
So number 7 says adds carbon storage to provisions require lessees to pay damages to landowners. So some of the wording in the bills and some of this is causing great concern for some of our constituents. I've seen everything from we're going to inject hazmat to we're going to inject nuclear waste into the ground. So I want to be very, very clear, and this is part of what I want to read into the record, is this Stancliff report in the executive summary, if you'll indulge me for a minute, Chair McKay.
Okay, please proceed.
It says, carbon capture, utilization, and storage is the process of separating carbon dioxide from exhaust gas streams of industrial processes. Carbon dioxide is a naturally occurring, it's all around us right now. It further says, collecting and transporting the carbon dioxide for storage with the intent that the carbon dioxide will be utilized for other activities or stored, such as enhanced oil recovery, or stored in perpetuity, which is called sequestration. CCUS has been occurring globally for over 40 years, first for use in enhanced oil recovery activities in the United States and later for sequestration in certain projects in Norway. So I just want to be very, very clear. You know, this seems scary because it says damages. And as I said, I've seen, you know, things posted on social media that we are going to allow companies to inject hazmat into Alaska. Nothing could be further from the truth, and we've been doing this for a long time. So no real need to comment. I just want to make sure that that was in the record. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative McCabe. Rep. Sadler.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Crowther, item 5, DNR, the mineral estate disposal exemption for ag lands. I just want to make sure I understand, if someone owns land designated in perpetuity as agriculture land, it's that they cannot dispose of the subsurface estate. Is that correct? And this, I just want to see how this flows through, what this means.
If I may take that question, Rep. Sadler, through the chair, basically, when the state disposes of lands for agricultural purposes, there's a deed restriction that land only be used for agricultural purposes. In that section of the code that deals with the disposal for ag purposes, there's a specific provision that says that mineral exploitation is allowed on those lands, and that's going to be by a lessee of the state. So the state sells the subsurface estate and says, hey, surface owner, you can only use this for agricultural purposes, or, you know, maybe you can build one house on it, something like that. There's some specific provisions in there. But when it severs those lands, there's this provision in 3805.069 that says that minerals can still be leased as to those agricultural lands or sequestered as the bill proposes.
So you have the right to, again, ag land is designated for surface use, but this just says the state may lease the subsurface rights to somebody else, including for carbon capture.
That's absolutely correct, through the chair.
Okay, Rep. Mears?
I'm a little short on finding the language really quickly, but in the sectional analysis, it is just carbon capture for the mineral uses.
So that provision currently has a range of statutes. So that's AS 3805-135 through 3805-183. That includes the majority of our mineral leasing provisions, and then it adds or carbon storage under 3805-700. So we have that range of statutes for our mineral leasing provisions, and including oil and gas, and then we add the range of statutes for carbon storage to that range, basically. I just looked over to my legal counsel to make sure I said that correctly, and she says yes.
Okay, please continue, Mr. O'Quinn.
Okay, so I believe I finished with Section 7, that split estate issue. And just to reiterate, you know, this statute is on the books, and we're adding that provision. We're adding to that provision just this range of statutes for carbon sequestration. Section 8 through 11 deals with the receiving of funds under various mineral leasing provisions The oil and gas leasing provisions adopt this kind of receding, and it deals with, you know, how the interest is charged, when the rents are due, that sort of thing. This is really just a conforming amendment to bring those sort of receding provisions to applicability to our carbon leasing bill. Section 12 deals with our essentially setting aside coal resources when someone locates a coal reserve. And there's already an exemption for leasing of those reserves for coal bed methane development or gas only leasing. And we're essentially adding carbon to those exemptions. So basically, you know, so unminable coal seams have the potential to hold carbon dioxide. And so we don't want this provision. We don't want the a coal mining company to be able to prevent the storage of carbon dioxide in an unminable coal, so a deeper coal or something that, you know, that wouldn't be targeted by a coal mining company. Section 13 prohibits carbon storage leases in Kachemak Bay, much like oil and gas operations and leasing is prohibited in Kachemak Bay. And then without further ado, we'll get to our leasing section, section 14, which is a little longer. So I'll be moving on if there's no...
Yeah, Mr. O'Quinn, I just want to make... when I was a freshman down here last term, the one thing I had a real hard time putting my head around was the reverse sweep. So I want to make sure, especially our new members, if they have any questions about what that term non-sweepable up in number four... You want? We can give a brief explanation of how the sweep works, if you'd like. Wow, you guys are smarter than I was then. Okay. All right. Please proceed, Mr. O'Quinn.
If it makes you feel any better, I just learned about that this year. Okay. Just to bring us back to our project timeline here. So we're talking about the company has done some initial screening. They've looked at maps and geological literature, and they've decided that, hey, this kind of general area is probably good. So then they want to have the rights to that area. So that's when they're going to come in and they're going to invoke Section 14 of the bill in order to acquire those rights, so to get that site control. And so to start off, we have a policy statement. So this is Section 14 of the bill again, and we're in 05700. So we have a policy statement that carbon storage is in the public interest. 705 provides authority to the DNR to promulgate regulations related to these leasing provisions, these licensing provisions. And then Section 710 is where we get into our exploration licensing program, where it allows the commissioner to issue carbon storage exploration licenses that include minimum work commitments, minimum economic terms, bonding requirements, default provisions, renewal provisions, et cetera. And so, you know, we have that initial five-year term, and then there's also the ability, once that operator has acquired that Class 6 permit, to convert those exploration licenses to a lease. And so, you know, they might start out with 10,000 acres, and then they might delineate that 10,000 acres down to that kind of 3,400 acre size, or maybe larger, maybe smaller than that even. And then so once they go to the AOGCC for their permit and they say, this is the only acreage we need, then the rest of that acreage goes away, and they get a long-term lease for that acreage that they've delineated in that exploration process. 715 kind of governs some of the specific provisions for competition and disposal requirements of the department, best interest findings, competitive processes are required. We do have in Section 715H, I just want to call this out because it is a bit different than how we handle oil and gas. We have a right of first refusal opportunity for existing mineral lessees. And the reason is they have the infrastructure in place. They have the subsurface knowledge typically. And also there's a greater potential for conflict if they're not also operating a carbon storage facility in that very specific footprint where they have the existing authorization. So they have the right of first refusal to meet the minimum or the economic terms proposed by the highest bidder if that proposal is on their lands that they already have leased for their mineral extractive activities, so oil and gas or mining.
Okay, Rep. Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That would seem to put us in a very poor bargaining position when it came to, you know, that we're going to get the minimum and nothing better than those. That would seem to be, Mr. Quinn, a benefit to the existing lessees, which they have already made an investment in Alaska, yes, but if we want to sell these on a competitive market, that seems to tie one hand behind our back by giving them that right to obtain it at the minimum cost.
Representative Sadler, through the chair, John Crowther here, I would just note that they don't have a right to obtain it at the minimum. They have a right, pursuant to the proposed legislation, to obtain it at the commercial terms proposed by other offers. So if there were multiple other offers, there was a competitive process, and that resulted in a either per acre or per ton injection fee much higher than the minimum, the landowner would have to meet that to have that right of first refusal.
Important distinction. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Okay, Rep. McCabe has a question.
So thank you, Chair McCabe. So what I think I heard you say is that there is a oil company in that footprint, and they have almost depleted their reservoir, and now they want to drill another hole, if you will, Title VI hole or whatever it's called, and inject that. They would have first rights to do that, provided that they met the highest bidder, so to speak, the contract provisions?
Representative McCabe, through the chair, that's exactly correct. We would engage in a competitive process that would generate the highest economic terms, and there would be a apparent high bidder, and then because that individual has that property right already within that footprint, they would have, if they wanted to acquire that property right, they would have to meet that highest bid provided. That was proposed.
Follow up.
Okay, please.
So the problem I see with that is, what's to prevent them from just doing it anyways? They're leasing the land. I mean, what's to prevent them from drilling a Title VI hole and we already have this lease for the next X number of years, and we're going to do what we want with it. In the state of Alaska, you can kind of go.
Buzz off.
Go fish.
Yeah, Representative McCabe, through the chair, John Crowther here. That we believe we've contemplated that scenario. So an existing operator does have the right to produce oil and gas from their leases, and that includes the right to inject things like carbon dioxide to enhance the production of oil and gas. So that's an allowed activity. They could drill new wells, potentially even a Class 6 well if they felt regulatorily they needed to do an oil and gas production purpose. Now, if they were doing a pure sequestration purpose, they have to acquire a carbon storage lease under this legislation. If it's a competitive process, they have to meet the other competitive terms. If they just want to convert an existing oil field without other third parties seeking it, there's a separate section of the bill that outlines that process. So they would have to acquire that right. Of course, we don't like to conceive of these situations, but if an operator said that, oh, we don't want to follow that law and regulation, then we would have to pursue compliance with them to bring them into compliance.
Yeah, go ahead, Kevin.
One more, if you'll indulge me. So just to kind of clear this up, so you, DNR, or we are saying that the pores left over, the porous material left over, is a separate resource from the oil that they have extracted already. And that's the resource now that we're contemplating selling to them for the storage. Is that about sum it up?
Representative McCabe, that's right on conceptually.
Yeah. Okay, thanks.
Yeah, to say it again, they would need a new lease and a completely new set of regulations to do the carbon injection, even if they operated the oil and gas field right in the same location.
That's correct. If it was for pure storage.
If it's pure for storage, yeah. Rep. Rauscher.
Well, through the chair, I was just. We're talking about the inlet and platforms. How does that factor in? I mean, they don't want to take the platform apart. We don't want to take the platform apart. And it's going to have to be some cooperation there, letting them be able to, I guess, do what we're talking about here without having to fight them for it. Isn't that right?
Representative Rauscher, through the chair, that is right, and that's why we included these provisions in the bill to allow that right of first refusal and to allow a process for an existing oil and gas operator to convert or expand into a storage lease, because that existing infrastructure is so valuable for it. They justifiably want to continue to realize that investment, and we want that investment to continue to be productive for the state. So,
one follow up.
Okay, please.
And just for clarification's sake, when we're talking about an installation, say an area where there could be property taxes involved, okay, that we may have to pay. I'm just wondering, is the installation the size of the well pad, or is it the size of the cavern in the ground? What are we paying taxes on in that regard?
Yeah, Representative Rauscher, through the chair, I think we'd want to have our Department of Revenue get back to you on the specifics of the property tax calculation and how that relates to the valuation of injected materials. But, you know, in short summary, oil and gas property, the surface infrastructure, the facilities associated are a primary driver of the production, or the property tax generated.
What's above the ground?
What's above the ground?
Sorry.
Thank you. I appreciate it. That's all I want was clarification. Thank you.
Oh, Rep. Mears, please.
So I wanted to follow through the next bit of this right of first refusal and, competitive gamesmanship, perhaps, with this process. I haven't thought this all the way through yet, but there are performance requirements, correct, for, you know, once you've approached this lease, once you have this, that you have to prove up. You can't just throw out this number, you know, outbid somebody that's already there, and then not follow through.
Representative Mears, through the chair, that's exactly correct. There's work commitments. There's also that these will be established by regulation, but some qualifications that will need to be met. You know, qualifications to operate as a storage operator. We would contemplate some sort of, you know, minimum level of experience required. And again, these are regulatory things that we would hope to develop as the market matures a bit. Yes, they could warehouse the acreage for a few years, I guess, by not meeting a work commitment, like acquiring it and not meeting a work commitment. But the idea is that in order to hold this property right, you have to complete your work commitment. And, certainly if an operator was just warehousing acreage, we wouldn't let them every 5 years get a new exploration license and not do anything with it. We would ensure that wasn't possible through our qualification regulations. And then just to get another point kind of raised by Representative Rauscher, in this conversion or requirement that an existing oil and gas operator acquire a storage lease once they convert to this, if they are not the same, if the storage operator is not the same as the oil and gas operator, there is a requirement that storage operator assume the dismantlement obligations for that equipment. So that's definitely relevant to Cook Inlet platforms. So we did contemplate that, and we do have a provision for that, and that's found in 3805.725, which we've more or less gotten to just through this conversation here.
Okay, Rep. Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, this is kind of how this is a novel perspective, novel aspects, which raises interesting questions. So to kind of follow up on Representative Rauscher's question, so in addition to the property taxation on surface infrastructure, does this bill contemplate applying a tax property value to the value of the injected gas and the value of the empty pore space, which is kind of like empty warehouse? You still assess based on the square footage of that empty warehouse.
Representative Sadler, through the chair, the bill does not contemplate taxation at all. It's merely a way for us to authorize the use of state property for this purpose, and then establish regulations or a framework for the AOGCC to have a permitting program and exercising its police powers, kind of to protect the subsurface and to protect the health and safety of the citizens of Alaska. The tax component was not addressed by this bill.
Follow up?
Through the chair, I wonder if the Department of Revenue may come to us with another governor's bill to plus this up on that side. I might be seeing ghosts where there aren't any, but that'd be interesting to see if they have something coming.
Okay, thank you, Rep. Sadler. Okay, please continue.
Sure. Let's see. I believe we're on 720, and I've basically covered this already, but there's a provision that allows that exploration license to be converted into that long-term lease, and that was kind of, as I described the process, they've delineated their reservoir, and then they go to apply for a permit, and in that permit process, they present facts about what acreage they're actually going to be using, and that's what they get to have their long-term lease on, not the full acreage that they initially acquired, unless that's what they're going to be using based on the geologic information they submit in their permitting process. 725, again, covers the conversion. Excuse me, I don't want to say conversion, but basically if an oil and gas operator is injecting into a formation for the purposes of enhanced oil recovery and they've gotten all the oil out of it that they can get, and then they say, all right, well, this looks pretty good for carbon sequestration, so we're going to start doing that. And they, because of that new goal and that new purpose of that well, they have to apply for that Class 6 permit. That triggers the obligation for them to come back to the DNR and seek that that storage lease on that same horizon or in a different horizon if they decide to do that. But it's generally thought of that they would be converting a Class 2 well to a Class 6 well, or maybe drilling a new well right near their Class 6 well. Mm-hmm. Let's see here. 730 requires the operators to report to the DNR their plans of development, operations, and unitization plans, very similar to our oil and gas leasing plans of development and unitization provisions. 735 again deals with Article 9, Section 15 of the Constitution. It just recognizes that provision of the Constitution and that mineral revenues, 25% of them are transferred to the permanent fund. And then we have 795, a definitions provision. So that's it for Section 14, which is the leasing licensing provision of the bill. I see we're at 2:30 here. Any other further questions on that?
Are you okay? I don't have my glasses on.
I do have a question, a short one.
Okay, Rep. Sadler, so, sorry.
Regarding that in 3805-725, is it a pretty simple, low-cost matter to convert a Class 2 injection well to a Class 6 injection well?
Through the chair, I don't have the answer to that question, unfortunately, and I don't know that it's ever been done before.
Oh, okay.
So
it'd require a workover of pretty substantial. You know, it's got a CO2 is very corrosive, so you could have to run a chrome tubing in the well, and it could be a pretty significant exercise. Could be, okay. I would say.
Thank you.
But if you really want to do it, you can. When there's a will, there's a way, you know. Okay. Please continue.
Okay, so we're going to get back into some of the conforming amendments and some other, you know, more straightforward, I'll say, parts of the bill. So sections 15 through 20 deal with our pipeline right-of-way leasing statutes, and basically what we're doing is we're bringing all of the carbon dioxide, all of the pipeline statutes, we're bringing them into conformance with this carbon dioxide provision. So we're going to allow carbon dioxide pipelines to be an authorization under our Pipeline Right-of-Way Leasing Act. We have certain exemptions for in-field lines. We're just adding those in-field lines for carbon dioxide to that exemption. We are bringing carbon dioxide into the definition of product, which will allow us to regulate our product pipelines for carbon dioxide. And then we're just kind of reforming some of our definitions, lease, pipeline facility, and transportation to include provisions for carbon dioxide. Pause there. questions. And then further, 21 is also, we're defining carbon dioxide in the same way we defined it in our leasing provision in section 14. Sections 22 through 30, there's a lot of reference to geothermal, and essentially what we're doing is we're taking Title 41, Chapter 6, and we're just dividing it into two articles. We're dividing it into a geothermal article, and then further along into our carbon dioxide article. And that's just simply that's where it best fit in the Alaska statutes. So we're not changing geothermal. We're not mixing geothermal with carbon dioxide. This is just a conforming amendment to reformat Title 41, Chapter 6 into two articles instead of one. Our next large section is Section 31, and this deals with the AOGCC permitting process. So I'll be getting into the specifics of that in the next slide. And then just to put this into context, our Section 31 happens kind of as the after leasing, before final investment decision. So, you know, they have a concept, they have a project design, and then they go to the AOGCC with that concept and project design and apply for this permit. And so we start out with 4106-105 with a policy statement that injecting carbon dioxide is in the public interest, that the AOGC will protect the waters of the state and reservoir integrity, so oil and gas reservoir integrity. And then, different provisions that are already in the AOGCC's statutory mandate are just imposed in the carbon dioxide context. And so 06110 specifically brings carbon dioxide into the jurisdiction of the AOGCC. Their waste prevention mandates, their correlative rights protection mandates, and their public health mandates. And then they define waste vis-a-vis carbon dioxide later on in the definition section, just for your reference. So we get into their authorities, and these are, again, kind of broad statements about the AOGC's authority. So they have police power over persons or property to carry out the purposes of this permitting regime. And so, again, DNR, property rights, the state's proprietary interest in the land, AOGCC, the state's police power. This is a regulatory authority to protect the states, to protect the geology, to protect the waters, and to protect public health. There is an exception for a suspension of the statutes when you're dealing with federal lands, and the AOGCC makes a finding that, you know, the federal provisions largely reflect the police powers that they already have. We have a provision that says that kind of wells drilled for carbon dioxide are kind of by default under their existing statutes for oil and gas. So as I've mentioned in previous hearings, there might be initial exploratory wells, stratigraphic wells, injectivity tests, flow tests, stuff like that. And so all of those kinds of wells would be permitted under AOGCC's Title 3105 power. And then it's the Class 6 that really gets into the injection well stuff. So this jurisdiction is already present in large part.
I think if I could bring it home to the public and the members of the committee, Mr. O'Quinn, my experience with the Oil and Gas Commission is they have substantial regulations and engineering requirements for fracking and protection of groundwater, protection of freshwater aquifers, a significant amount of engineering work that you have to demonstrate before they'll allow you to frack a well. So this seems to me to be very similar very similar to that, even though we're going to be under frac pressure. But I'm quite certain that they have significant protections in place for ensuring that, like I said, groundwater aquifers, freshwater drinking sources are not affected by this operation.
Chair McKay, that's exactly correct. And again, with the injection component, there's even an additional layer of groundwater, or I'll call it underground sources of drinking water protection through the Safe Drinking Water Act, the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act, and the Class 6 program. So that's exactly correct. And basically, this permits the operator to drill wells that are not injection wells in pursuit of these projects under the AOGCC's existing Title 31 regulations, which, as you said, are very protective. 4106.120 provides that waste is prohibited in a carbon storage facility, and that is defined in 4106.210.
Okay, Rep. McCabe has a question.
So just to put it on the record again, and I know that we've been through this and we were through it last week, or this injection well is going to be 2,600 feet deep. That'll sort of be the top of it, right? It'll be deeper than 2,600 feet, right? Because I can't think of a water well.
It could be way deeper.
It could be deeper, but I mean, the top of it is 2,600 feet. That's the minimum pressure for it, right?
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, that's the minimum depth for the hydrostatic pressure to keep the CO2 at supercritical state. It's likely it would be deeper than that, and yes, far below your typical source of underground source of drinking water.
Thank you.
Just some of our reservoirs are 10,000, 12,000 feet deep. And that would be your objective, so you'd be way below the 2,600, just for the record.
Chair McKay, that's exactly correct. 2,600 feet is the absolute shallowest, but it's likely 4 or 5, maybe even more likely 7,000, 8,000 feet would be with the primary targets, or as you said, Chair, even deeper still.
Brett Mears?
So that's our technical limitation of what we're looking at for CO2 to remain supercritical, but still a lot to digest here. Is there a statutory requirement for a minimum depth for storage?
Representative Mears, through the chair, there is no statutory minimum. However, there is a broad regulatory authority granted to the AOGCC. And, I can't speak to them or speak for them, but I believe that, they would be promulgating regulations governing, the state of matter that the CO2 needs to remain in, or that sort of thing, as part of their regulatory requirements and their regulatory promulgation, as they're looking toward really building up the permit program to have, I'll get to these, but there's 14 permit requirements, and in order to kind of really flesh out those 14 requirements, they're going to have technical regulations that say, to meet requirement one, you have to fulfill these specifications for this, that, and the other. These haven't been developed yet because we, haven't empowered the agency to do that just yet, but they're thinking about this stuff and they're doing research on this stuff. And while there's no minimums in the statutes, we wanted to be as flexible as possible in the statute to allow them to develop the right regulatory program. We did, put really aspirational requirements in the permitting provisions in order to enable them to come up with technical standards to meet those 14 requirements in the permit.
Okay, Rep. McCabe.
Thank you, Chair McKay. So you said that waste is prohibited in a carbon storage reservoir, and you said that there was a definition somewhere of waste. And I'm interested to know which definition you're using. I know there's one in 46, AS46.03. Is that the one we're talking about, or you mentioned another one, I think?
And there's a reference to 210. We also have 4106060 that defines waste. And, you know, I can kind of read through some of that stuff. But basically the idea is to physical waste and includes inefficient, excess, or improper production, use, or dissipation. I'm sorry, I'm looking at geothermal there. Let me just move on to 210.
And Representative McCabe, through the chair, conceptually what we talk about when we say waste in these contexts is not efficiently using the state's resource. So an injector can't have a project that says, I'm going to just put a little in the reservoir and I'm going to not pressure it or maintain it. They have to, receive approval, they have to fully utilize the resource and have a plan to fully develop a project.
Okay. Thank you.
And through the chair, that definition can be found in the bill and 4106210. And that is inefficient, excessive, or improper operation of a storage facility. So it grants, you know, it's open-ended and allows the AOGCC the ability to work through that.
Thank you.
Okay, we have 15 minutes left, so let's continue on. We're doing very well. Thank you.
Okay, I believe I was 4106 provides permit requirements for storage facilities. 130 creates a public hearing requirement, and essentially notice is required to be given to all property owners within a half mile, both subsurface and surface. There's specific criteria in 4106-135 for the AOGCC to approve the permit. That's the 14 requirements. 140 allows them to add parameters in the permit to protect even further than those 14 requirements. 4106-145 empowers the AOGCC to kind of pool or amalgamate property rights that overlie a storage reservoir to ensure that waste is not committed and that subsurface trespass is not committed, and ensures that the correlative rights of those parties are protected. There's a certificate requirement. So basically once this permit's issued, a certificate is generated and that gets recorded. And that ensures that property, you know, future property buyers are on notice. There's a certificate in the title chain to indicate that the surface or that the storage facility is in place. There's specific statutory requirements for environmental protection and reservoir integrity in 06-155. Those are, you know, also kind of present in the by implication in the permit requirements, but there is a specific statutory obligation to ensure environmental protection and reservoir integrity. There is a provision in 4106-160 to deal with the preservation of existing rights. So that would be existing extractive rights, and to deal with that interface.
Okay, Rep. Mears, please.
This should be quick. So with that certificate that that property is being utilized for this, you know, in my experience, it's something that gets recorded with the title. Is that the intent?
Representative Mears, through the chair, that is correct. There is a requirement that it's recorded. And so, you know, a title company would pick that up in a title insurance policy. So it would be the property purchaser would be on notice.
Okay. Rep. Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. O'Quinn, section 155 shall take action to ensure no substances can compromise the integrity. I thought there was nothing more corrosive than carbon dioxide. What kinds of substances might compromise integrity of a reservoir?
So, Representative Sadler, through the chair, not to speak above my technical training, but when we talk about reservoir integrity, we're talking about maintaining the pressure within it. So that would be requirements that the injector have plans not to overpressure or inject it at rates that are incorrect. It's not so much the chemical behavior of carbon dioxide in the reservoir. And in a general sense, not just for general awareness, we talk about carbon dioxide being corrosive. That's in the presence of water, in to metals at the surface. when it's compressed and supercritical in the context of these geologic reservoirs, it's our understanding, and we can have our Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys confirm this, there is interaction with the reservoir space to form carbonates and other naturally occurring substances, but that's not, it doesn't corrode the reservoir in the way that carbon dioxide in the presence of water in a metal would have an acidic effect.
Yeah, in the reservoir context, integrity means you have a trap, you have boundaries, the CO2 cannot escape into the atmosphere or anywhere else, it's trapped.
Right.
That's usually what integrity means.
But Rep. Sadler? Through the chair, subsection 1 specifically mentions substances that compromise integrity. That specifically calls out substances. What kind of substances might those be?
If I may, there is a definition of carbon dioxide, and it says, I believe it's in 210, but it deals with purity. So, you know, it just means when you're injecting carbon dioxide only, and that you're not injecting something else, or maybe it's other things, but those other things, whether they're, particulate matter or something like that, that they're not going to clog the reservoir, that sort of thing.
That's the answer. Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. Okay, please continue.
So just revisiting 160 real quick. So deconfliction of development, between development and injection operations, there's a provision that allows the AOGCC to kind of set rules about drilling through one formation or another to access a storage formation or a production formation, that sort of thing, or possibly a water formation. 165 allows the AOGCC to collect those regulatory cost charge fees that we discussed earlier in those revenue slides. 170 deals with the title to carbon dioxide, and on a statutory basis establishes that title is vested in the operator until such time that the facility receives a closure certificate and that title transfers to the state. So section 175 specifies the criteria for receiving that certificate, and there's eight factors in there, and again, I would expect that those factors would be fleshed out through a regulatory process. 180 allows the AOGCC to collect a surcharge for post-closure administration. So they have their ongoing operations administrative fund, and then they have this carbon storage trust fund. So this is the part that deals with the carbon storage trust fund, and that's designed to cover the liabilities of the state once the operator is out of the picture. We have 4106-185 allows the AOGC to impose penalties much the same way they may for oil and gas operators that run afoul of their statutes and regulations. The carbon storage statutes are specifically excluded from enhanced oil recovery. That's already covered by the AOGCC's existing power in 3105. We want that to continue. We want enhanced oil recovery to continue in the oil and gas context. But we do have that transition slide in our leasing, or that transition moment in our leasing provisions when they transition from enhanced oil recovery to pure sequestration operations. 195 is just a general provision that allows them to enter into cooperative agreements with other government agencies to carry out the purposes of this chapter. 4106 allows the AOGC, or excuse me, 4106-200 allows the AOGCC to certify storage amounts for the purposes of perhaps claiming these carbon credits. They can say, okay, this many tons of carbon, here's our thing. You can do this. You can file that on your taxes now. And then we have the definition section that I've referenced a few times already in 06210. So that's it for title for section 31. I'll pause.
Rep. Sadler, of course.
Of course, yes. Well, I appreciate the chance to ask these questions. I truly do. In section 31, the reference to 4106-170. My question is this. This is kind of a broad question regarding the entire concept of carbon sequestration storage. What is the state's liability that we'd be taking on? What does the operator have for 10 years and then the state hereafter? What's the risk in capturing this much carbon dioxide? And is it escaping, blowing away, paying back the credits? You know, what risk are we assuming?
So, Representative Sadler, through the chair, you know, I think it's the state's position. There's a couple of dynamics at play here. So the ongoing operation, you know, as we talked about earlier, from a chemical sense, you know, not from a pure regulatory sense, but carbon dioxide is not a highly hazardous gas in the way that some of the other materials that are handled in industrial operations are. But of course, when an operator is operating the facility and when they have the liability, the third party operator, everything, you know, a slip and fall in the walkway to a pipe or valve break to a workplace misconduct, all of those kind of liabilities and operations are part of their responsibility for safe operations regulated through a variety of laws, including the AOGCC terms here. And that's where we see the primary liability. Now, one of the motivations for the state taking longer term liability entitled to the CO2 is that it does maintain, sit in the reservoir. The goal is to have CO2 sitting there essentially perpetually. If you're going to ask a lawyer or an insurance company or a business to maintain that liability forever, whatever may happen in 100 years, that creates, they try and put a price on that, they try and contract around it, but it creates very challenging commercial realities. That's what we've seen in other jurisdictions, that folks say, well, we understand the operational risk, we understand the technical process risk, the commercial risk, but you're telling us that we have to maintain some liability on our books for 100 years for the CO2 underground. We don't know how to put a number on that, so we're a little hesitant to move forward with financing. In those situations, other states have said, we're going to assume that title. We're going to own the CO2 underground. The default is that it will sit there. There's a possibility that it will have some migration to a different reservoir. But that activity would be the state's liability longer term, addressed through that long-term trust fund. But, you know, for instance, one very, very theoretical. What happened if a third party drilled through a storage reservoir the state had title to, maintain the liability for, and that communication with an existing development reservoir created a liability? Not, you know, and this is a subsurface context where now there's carbon dioxide flowing into an otherwise productive reservoir that complicates that production operation. Someone might say, well, that the person who owns that carbon dioxide is liable for the impact to the ongoing development operations. Now, we would likely say the person who irresponsibly drilled through and connected the reservoirs is primarily liable. But the state may also have to participate in that to resolve those rights. That's one very hypothetical situation. But those are the kinds of long-term liabilities that we think is reasonable for the state to assume to allow these projects to go forward. And that, you know, the production from the trust fund is kind of further insurance to protect the state's interest in a long-term sense. As Director LePain, our state geologist, mentioned, from a trap and seal perspective, there's very, you know, there hasn't been observed risk of some sort of, you know, 7,000-8,000-foot reservoir released to surface. You know, we live in these areas. We don't see that occur, whether it's seismic, whether it's drilling, whether it's injection. We already don't see that. And so there's no reason to expect there'd be that kind of liability associated with these operations either.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Crowther, a couple of comments that I would make is you just kind of touched on it. There are some situations that I think the Oil and Gas Commission will need to take into account when they do their work on this. And one of them is there's three scenarios. You can have a CO2 disposal zone, let's say at 3,000 feet, let's say it's pressured up. It's below frac pressure, but it's still pressured up. And another operator wants to come in, or maybe even the same operator wants to come in and drill an oil and gas well through that zone with a deeper zone as his objective. So he will have to drill through that pressured up zone, and that situation can be covered under the Oil and Gas Commission engineering design specs and regulations. Likewise, you could have an under pressured zone that you want to drill through, and that creates another set of problems. But again, that can be covered under the Oil and Gas Commission regulations. I don't believe that you would cover it under the framework of the bill. That's far too technical. It's for the commission to figure that out.
Yeah.
Now, another scenario I can foresee here, is operator A could have a class 6 CO2 disposal well and reservoir, let's say onshore Cook Inlet. And there may be another operator, B and maybe C, D, who would want to dispose of their CO2 in that well. So we have one well and we have three disposal companies, right? Have you thought about that? So each of them has to pay the state to use that well. So without giving this few minutes left here, can you just, have you thought about that scenario where you, like today we have, we only have so many class 2 disposal wells. Hillcorp operates one on the slope, and you know, so they charge other operators to bring waste to their class 2 well. How would that work if one operator had a class 6 CO2 well?
Chair McKay, you know, the operator and owner of that, holder of that exploration license, would pay the state their injection charge, and they would toll the other operator, they would toll the other sources, you know, some sort of fee. That'd be a commercial arrangement between them. And, you know, there with pipelines, there's always the potential for, you know, involvement of.
Okay. So you've thought about that in the bill. And the other problem you could have is operator A won't let operator B use their well. Like, operator A won't let operator B use the roads. Have we thought about that in the bill?
Yeah, Chair McKay, you know, as far as, you know, kind of a question of open access to wells, you know, that from a storage perspective, the operator would be acquiring those exclusive rights. So we do think under the conception of the bill, just like in an oil and gas context from the development facilities, there is that exclusive right for the sequestration. If a third party wanted to participate in that, they'd have to come to commercial terms. Now, obviously, if someone said, we don't want to let you drive across the lot in our storage facility, we believe that would be analogous to some other issues we've seen.
Okay, we better wrap it up. I first want to thank the committee for your very hard work today. Sledding through a sectional analysis on a difficult bill is not easy. Thank you for your contributions both today and in the future. Gentlemen, thank you for being here today. I will now set HB 50 aside until Friday. Seeing no other business, the next committee meeting will be held at 1 o'clock on Friday, February 17th. This meeting is adjourned at 3:01 p.m.